All right, our topic for tonight will be American Jewry, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and the Holocaust, part one. Well, actually, this is part two of a three-part series on Roosevelt and the Jews. But last week was about the pre-war era. And tonight we're going to discuss the early phases of the war. And then next time we'll finish off the topic with the late stages of the war. As I did last time, I request that you all stay muted throughout the whole presentation, and we'll go to questions when there are 5 minutes left, just because I know this is a very controversial topic, and I want to get my version of the story out there before we go to everybody's questions. So I kindly request your cooperation in that regard. Okay, so we got up to the part after Kristallnacht. It's now November, December of 1938, going into January of 39, and Roosevelt was thinking about the resettlement of Jews in Latin America. And in his view, large swaths of open territory existed in certain countries that needed investment capital and skilled professionals. So it's a good shidduch, have the Jews go to Latin America. But certain Latin American countries regarded Jews as politically radical and unsuited for manual labor. But if the Jews were middle class, white collar types in Europe, are they really going to push a plow with a mule somewhere in Latin America? Didn't seem very likely. Now, Isaiah Bowman was one of FDR's advisors on these matters. And Bowman was a racist and a eugenicist who didn't like Jews. And he thought the Jews could not be pioneers and work in harsh climates. So anytime there was a thought to put a bunch of Jews in an out of the way place somewhere in the Americas, he would put the kibosh on it. Henry Morgenthau Jr., Secretary of the Treasury, alerted FDR to the possibility of Jews moving to Costa Rica because Costa Rica needed financing of its $5 million debt that it had to the United States. So the U.S. had some kind of hold over them. But Bowman scuttled the idea by claiming that a small Latin American country could be ruined by the arrival of too many political subversives, a.k.a. Jews. Now, Bowman wasn't a Nazi, but he didn't empathize with the victims of Nazism. There was talk of moving the Jews to Africa, but the cost was prohibitive. First of all, it couldn't be to South Africa, which was a sort of a civilized country, and it couldn't be to Italian Ethiopia, because that was off limits for other reasons, but to other parts of Africa, but it would cost $5,000 per family. It was prohibitively expensive. Samuel Rosenman, who had the ear of the president, suggested moving many Jews to one protectorate, whereas Bowman wanted to scatter Jews all around the world so that in no single place would there be too many of them, they wouldn't cause trouble. Morgenthau suggested canceling the war debts from World War I of the British, the French, and the Dutch in exchange for settling Jews in the Guianas. The follow-up question, of course, would be who would administer such a country, not a country, but some kind of a settlement. And there was no good answer because the Americans didn't want to do it. So settlement prospects were not very strong in Latin America, but they did remain viable in the Dominican Republic, even after the war began in September of 39. But anything that could go wrong with the Dominican Republic scheme did go wrong. Ultimately, despite an offer of 100,000 people being allowed to come into the country, only 757 Jewish refugees made it to the Dominican Republican settlement at Sasua. And most refugees could not transform themselves into farmers. So didn't go very well. Bolivia, of all places, welcomed the largest number of Jewish refugees per capita of any country in the Western Hemisphere. Why? So a combination of a corrupt government, of an indigenous Bolivian Jewish community that had strong political leadership that got the job done, and a lot of luck, some mazel. Between 1938 and 1941, approximately 20,000 Jews entered Bolivia, although some quickly moved to other countries like Brazil and Argentina. In 1939, Chile let in approximately 8,000 Jews, some buying visas from corrupt officials. So there was a lot of backroom deals and shenanigans on the part of people who were making money, but Jews got into the country. Chile closed its doors a year later in 1940. As for Brazil, it let in 10,000 Jews between 1938 and 1942. The most famous of all these endeavors was the attempt to get Jews into Cuba. So for those of you from the Young Israel of Woodmere watching at home, okay, you recall about a year ago, before the pandemic, we did a movie night, and I give a presentation on the Jews of Cuba. And the name of the movie was Cuba's Forgotten Jewels, because there was a diamond industry that was quite successful from about 1939 through 1945-46 in Havana, and that a substantial number of Jews did find safe haven in Cuba. There also was Nazism in Cuba and right-wing fascist sentiment that was not happy about the arrival of some Jews, but on the whole, it was good to be there, and it was also good to leave when the war was over and come to America. Cuba as a destination for Jews played a role in the story of the St. Louis. Now, we're not going to spend too much time on the story of the St. Louis. It's been covered many, many times before, including in some of my previous classes. But suffice it to say that there were 937 Jewish refugees aboard the ship. Many of them had, nearly all of them had transit visas through Cuba to go to other places, including Venezuela. Many had permanent visas for Venezuela. But as it turned out, a lot of these visas were canceled while the ship was at sea. And they were of dubious validity to begin with, so the captain of the ship required people to have passage for return home anyway. Formally, America could not let in those people who did not have a place to which they could return. And since these were essentially stateless refugees, they had no place to return. And so the U.S. government or the federal government was not in much of a position to allow the St. Louis passengers to get off the boat at an American port. There was a suggestion to temporarily house them in the U.S. Virgin Islands, but that was quickly rejected. Roosevelt feared that if he acted to evade the immigration laws, in other words, just break the rules and let people in, that Congress would then refuse to revise the Neutrality Act, which was a big deal to him in 1939, that the Neutrality Act was hampering his ability to assemble an anti-Nazi coalition in the Western world, and he wants those laws changed, which, you know, they will be in significantly in 1940 and 41 in the buildup before Pearl Harbor. But in 1939, in May and June, Roosevelt is very reluctant to break any rules lest Congress cripple his ability to conduct foreign policy. So in the end, an agreement was reached. And that agreement was that four countries would take the passengers of the St. Louis. It would be Belgium, France, Great Britain, and the Netherlands. Belgium agreed first, and the other three countries followed suit. Now, at the time, it's important to recognize that at the time, Jewish advocacy groups in the United States and the passengers themselves on the ship regarded this as a successful solution to their problem. It was not the same thing as being in the Western Hemisphere or entering the United States, but landing somewhere that was going to provide asylum that wasn't Nazi Germany was good. We know now that those who remained in continental Europe were in big trouble just a year later, and that those who went to England would be safe. But in June of 1939, nobody knows that yet. So in the movie The Voyage of the Damned, which I suggest you see, although it has a lot of fictitious elements to it, it falsely claims that 600 people from the St. Louis died in the Shoah. That's not true. Only the best guesstimate is that 254 Jewish refugees who were sent back to continental Europe died in the Holocaust. Now, in the years 1938 to 1942, approximately 60,000 Jews made it to Latin America. American ideas for resettlement in Latin America were ill-conceived and basically botched. So the Roosevelt administration's efforts to get this done did not work out all that well, and the numbers were pretty small compared to what he had in mind. However, it's important to notice that if FDR had been completely indifferent to Jewish suffering and had done nothing to promote the Latin American schemes, then the number 40,000 would have been a lot smaller. So as much as some want to blame Roosevelt for so-called indifference, there were thousands of people who were saved in other countries in the late 30s, early 40s, courtesy of American efforts that were his doing and were contrary to the wishes of the State Department and others. Okay. Germany took over the bulk of Czechoslovakia 82 years ago today. March 15th, the Ides of March, 1939, 82 years ago. So Bohemia and Moravia were taken over, and a Slovak Republic, a fascist Slovak Republic was set up. But all of a sudden, even more Jews, the Jews of Prague, are under Nazi control. So just like as was the case with the Anschluss and the takeover of Vienna a year earlier on March 12, 1938, suddenly the problem of the refugee crisis and the need for rescue and resettlement has grown by a large factor, because a city with a lot of Jews, a territory with a substantial number of Jews, is now under Nazi control. So in Chicago, a Jewish woman and her small children jumped out of the 13th floor window of a hotel and died. Now, what happened? They were Czech Jews in the United States on temporary tourist visas, and thought they were going to have to go back to Czechoslovakia, which was no longer Czechoslovakia, but now was Nazi-controlled Europe. And so they died rather than go back. This was a big to-do in the news in Chicago. And Adolf Sabbath, who was a Republican Jewish congressman from Illinois, had an audience with FDR. And Roosevelt agreed that those Jews who came from parts of continental Europe that would be taken over by the Germans would not have to go back. They could stay indefinitely on temporary visas, just as he had done previously for the German and Austrian quota, that if you were here on a temporary visa, you didn't have to go home. Okay. Well, in 1939, Roosevelt did not try to loosen immigration laws by legislation. He rested on his earlier efforts from prior years, where the quotas had been, efforts to increase the filling of the quota had been achieved, and the rules about documentation were relaxed, and about who can sponsor a relative and what kind of a relative. There had been earlier efforts by the administration to make things easier for refugees to access the United States, and he rested on his laurels. In other words, no further effort by legislation. Instead, he wanted other countries to take in refugees, and he would continue to cook up schemes for that to happen, even though these were long-shot schemes that were unlikely to be successful, but that's what he wanted his advisors to give him. Okay. On January 30th, 1939, Hitler gave a major speech at the Reichstag, in which he accused international Jewish financiers of trying to foment another world war. And this rhetoric had an impact in the United States. People came to believe that Jews controlled everything. The Nazi propaganda in America accused the Roosevelt administration of being the Baruch, Rosenman, Frankfurter, Morgenthau, B'nai B'rith administration of a Christian republic. So you throw in all the Jewish-sounding names, oh, they're dominating the country. Okay? So some American Jews were deeply concerned about the popular idea that Jews have too much power. And these Jews were willing to act to constrict Jewish power just so that the Goyim don't think we have too much power. Okay? So where did this play out? For example, with court appointments. Benjamin Cardozo, who had been appointed by Herbert Hoover, died in 1938, the summer of 38. Roosevelt wanted to put Felix Frankfurter on the court. But Arthur Hayes Sulzberger of the New York Times and others like him, he wasn't the only one, lobbied against the appointment. Frankfurter himself said that a number of prominent Jews who are unwittingly embracing Hitlerism, their suggestion that Jews not be called to public life because they are Jews is, for me, indistinguishable from Nazism. So here you have Frankfurter, who's about to be appointed to the court, saying, Jews who oppose my appointment, just dafka because I'm a Jew, they're embracing Hitlerism and don't even realize they're doing it. Okay. Well, Roosevelt considered delaying the appointment of Frankfurter until after Brandeis retired from the court so that there wouldn't be two Jewish justices. In other words, Cardozo was dead. If Brandeis retires, we're down to zero. You appoint Frankfurter, we're back up to one. But if you appoint Frankfurter now before Brandeis retires, and you have two, and that'd be too much. In the end, after Kristallnacht and a change in public sentiment about Jews, you know, slightly more favorable that they were victims of Nazism. So he did appoint Frankfurter even before Brandeis retired. Anti-Semites accused Felix Frankfurter of not being an American citizen, like a birtherism argument. Frankfurter came to the United States from Germany when he was 8 years old, and he got citizenship when he was 13. So he had to go dig up the papers from the, you know, from the archives to prove that he was a real American citizen, because the vicious anti-Semites were out to get him. Even leading American Jews and advocates of rescue were not calling for radical changes to the quota laws in early 1939. Instead, they were calling for an adjustment of the quota laws, modest adjustments that would work in the favor of Jews. So, for example, Emanuel Seller, congressman from Brooklyn, okay, some of you might have been in his district in the old days, he said we should use the unfilled quotas from other countries in order to allow German Jewish refugees to come to enter into America. In other words, whatever the total allowable immigration is for a given year, it's going unused from a lot of other countries. So lump it all together and use it to its fullest, not even one more than the quota, but to a maximum quota of the whole world, but use it for German Jewish refugees. So when he suggested this in the halls of Congress, several of his colleagues from Western and Southern states told him politely or not so politely that if you try that, we'll abolish immigration altogether, or at minimum, we'll slash the quota in half. So don't try to pull that one on us. Another suggestion in early 1939 was to allow a sizable number of unaccompanied minors into the United States outside the quotas. You know, we have today a crisis at the southern border, unaccompanied minors. But in 1939, this was a big to-do, unaccompanied minors, but they were Jews. So James G. McDonald thought that it would be politically less risky for Jewish children, refugee children, to enter outside the quota than it would be for Roosevelt's administration to try to change the quota by law. So what followed was the Wagner-Rogers Bill, which you might have heard of, the Wagner-Rogers Bill. It was co-sponsored by Senator Robert Wagner of New York, a liberal New Deal Democrat. And he was a Catholic, too, which was important that the Catholics be on board with this. And the representative in the House of Representatives was Edith Norse Rogers, who was a liberal Republican from Massachusetts. Eleanor Roosevelt enthusiastically supported this bill, which called for 20,000 Jewish children to enter outside the quota over a span of the next 2 years. So 10,000 a year for 2 years. And the precedent for it was the Kinder transport to England that had happened right around the same time. Well, Franklin Roosevelt was quiet. Eleanor said, wonderful idea, rescue the children. Franklin was quiet. Herbert Hoover, of all people, supported the bill. Now, Hoover, again, was never an anti-Semite. Herbert Hoover was a good man who gets a bum rap in history for having a less than stellar presidency. But outside of his presidency, his public career was a distinguished career. And in this instance, he supported the Wagner-Rogers Act. The bill died, however, in committee. What happened? Opponents said, well, we would rather have 20,000 old Jews who won't reproduce than 20,000 Jewish children who will eventually have children of their own. Now, that's real racism. Saying, you know, we'll take the old codgers because they won't have children, but no kids because they're gonna prove Vumi Lewis Aretz and ruin America. A Gallup poll revealed that 2/3 of Americans around this time did not want to let Jewish refugee children in. The Daughters of the American Revolution, the DAR, a great nemesis of the American Jewish community, and other patriotic societies lobbied heavily against the bill. When it came up for a vote, Roosevelt himself issued instructions to file no action. In other words, do nothing about it. Let it die in Congress. Don't let me have a hand in it. The Congressional Committee instead took up bills calling for a 5-year halt to all immigration and for the fingerprinting of all aliens. So had FDR openly and overtly supported the Wagner-Rogers bill, it might have made a difference. You know, it's one of these things in the subjunctive. We don't know because it didn't happen. But had he supported the bill, maybe it would have worked. And maybe 20,000 Jewish kids would have been saved. But he didn't do it. And the svara, the logic behind why he didn't, was that he feared risking the anti-Nazi coalition that he was building, in the sense that, you know, he has a foreign policy which is anti-Hitler, anti-Nazi, pro-war with Germany eventually once there's a pretext, and that pretext is Pearl Harbor and Germany's declaration of war in the United States eventually. But until we get to that point, most of America doesn't want to know from anti-Nazism and doesn't want to be on a war footing. And if he supports Jewish refugee children being entered into the country, then he runs the risk that Congress will just turn its back against him and there will be isolationism running amok. Okay. The Intergovernmental Committee on Refugees, which had been founded after Evian in 1938, was directed by George Rubley. Rubley traveled to Germany in early January of 1939 to see if it was possible to negotiate an orderly exodus of German Jews. But he was told by the head of the Reichsbank, who was not an avowed Nazi, but was like a moderate Nazi, that the extreme Nazis don't want to see any orderly exit of Jews. Why? Unstated is we want to kill all the Jews. All right, but basically, this convinced Rubley, we're not going to make this work. There's no way we're going to have an orderly exit. There's no refugee solution. It isn't going to happen. And so he resigned from his position. The State Department official, Raymond Geist, anticipated what was going to happen next, that there would be no deals. For all the discussions, there'd be no deal. The Germans would send Jews on boats to nowhere without, whether to Shanghai or to Thailand or wherever, without visa papers. And they would confiscate all the Jewish possessions. They'd push Jews across the international frontiers, push them over the border physically. And then when that wasn't enough, they'd kill people and there'd be mass murder. So there were State Department officials in 1939 who understood where this was all headed. They may not have said it explicitly, but they understood implicitly where it was headed. There was talk in early 1939 of a Havara-style agreement between the United States and Germany. Now, for those who don't remember, the Havara agreement, the transfer agreement, was a deal between the Zionist organization and Nazi Germany to allow for German Jews to go to Palestine and for Palestine Jewry to import German industrial goods in exchange for the Germans basically confiscating all German Jewish possessions, or almost all. This was a deal that was good for everybody. It was good for the Germans because they got to keep a lot of assets. It was good for Eretz Yisrael Jewry because they got industrial goods. And it was good for the German Jewish refugees because they got to live and not get killed. So it was good for everybody, but it was good for the Germans. And does America want anything that's good for the Germans? Well, probably not. So American Jewish leaders feared that a Havara-style agreement between America and Germany would confirm the impression that there is such a thing as organized international Jewry capable of arranging these sorts of things. And it would condone German theft of Jewish assets, and it would materially strengthen Germany, which, it's not good, and you don't want to be seen as facilitating that. By May 1939, Roosevelt recognized that haste was essential because we're running out of time, that war is on the horizon in the very near future. He was right vis-a-vis Europe, not the United States. 4 months later, Europe would be at war. Roosevelt tried to pitch settlement plans to the isolationists in Congress and in public opinion, on the grounds that it would prevent war, meaning, the Jews are a problem in Europe for the Europeans. If we get the Jews out of Europe, then the problem goes away and maybe we avert war. Not in such blunt terms, but in pretty similar terms. Roosevelt wanted long-term solutions to the overcrowding of Europe, but also short-term plans to rescue German Jewish refugees. Unfortunately, on both of those fronts, the long-term and the short-term, he failed in 1939 to accomplish anything of any significance. Okay, now the war broke out on September 1st, 1939. And when it did, there was a realization on the part of the non-Zionist or even anti-Zionist Jews that Zionism had actually served some useful purpose. And I want to read to you a quote. The American Jewish Committee explained, "There is less ground today for opposition to the Jewish national home development and even to political Zionism than there was before Hitler's ascension to power, because in spite of the many mistakes made by the Zionists in the past, it is widely recognized that had there been no Zionist movement, Palestine today would still be largely a desert with as little opportunity for settlement of Jews as British Guiana or Madagascar." In other words, we had our chance to rescue people for 6 years after the rise of Nazism, before the start of the war. You had 6.5 years. And where did a lot of Jews go? Eretz Yisrael. Not as many as we would have wanted, because the British, you know, kept caps on, put limits on things, but a lot of Jews went to Eretz Yisrael. Well, had it not been for Zionism, says the anti-Zionists, Palestine would be a desert, and it would be like Madagascar. Nobody went to Madagascar, so nobody would have gone to Palestine if not for Zionism. So this is the American Jewish Committee, the reform, you know, assimilationist crowd, saying basically the same thing as Agudas Yisrael from the ultra-Orthodox perspective of, yeah, we were anti-Zionist, but if not for Zionism, a lot more people would have died. Okay, so after the war started, Roosevelt wanted the Intergovernmental Committee on Refugees to continue finding settlement solutions. But advocates of rescue faced opposition from those who would say that, why are you going out of your way to protect only the Jews when the whole world is suffering from the ravages of war? So that, this is a new argument. It used to be, why are you so concerned about the Jews? After all, who likes the Jews? You know, it's grotesque anti-Semitism. Now it's, why are you so worried about the Jews? You're gonna have to worry about all of humanity, because we're in a world war. Okay, Jewish leaders feared a backlash if it were publicly perceived that the administration's policymakers were inordinately preoccupied with helping Jews. The British sought to kill any rescue efforts because they thought that if Germany released its Jews, they would be doing so only to relieve domestic economic pressures, or to send out spies under the cloak of a Jewish refugee. FDR wanted to send 200,000 Jews to an out-of-the-way place, meaning the war is starting, we've run out of time for any serious rescue efforts of an orderly fashion to civilization. But what about these random out-of-the-way places? So Francis Perkins, the Secretary of Labor, cooked up an idea to send 250,000 Jews to Alaska. Alaska. Sounds like a good idea, you know? Alaska needs people. They're always paying people to go to Alaska. But what happened? The idea didn't go very far. Roosevelt did not support it. And just like was the case with the Wagner-Rogers bill, Roosevelt was quiet, not publicly opposing nor publicly supporting the Alaska bill in February of 1940. Domestic opposition in Alaska among the Gentiles killed the bill. Roosevelt guessed that any overt support for rescue would embolden congressional foes to take immigration and foreign policy in a direction that Roosevelt didn't want. And so despite whatever sympathy he might have had for the cause of rescue, he took no chances in risking the anti-Nazi orientation of the country. As the war started, there was a growing concern for national security. National security, what am I talking about? Well, a Nazi spy ring was found in New York in 1938, and there was a concern about a fifth column, just as the Nazi takeover of Norway was attributed to a so-called fifth column, so too would happen in other countries. There were claims made that Nazi agents entered France under disguised as Jewish refugees. Breckinridge Long was appointed the Assistant Secretary of State for special war problems. He was ambitious, he was underhanded, he was xenophobic, he was a Jew hater. And he's regarded by many students of American Jewish history as the ultimate villain in this saga. You know, some people want to make Roosevelt the ultimate villain in this saga, and they shouldn't. But others want to make Breckinridge Long the ultimate villain, and maybe they're right. He was pretty bad. Alternatively, he's considered a symbol for the retrograde State Department. That, you know, the State Department, Bechlal in general, was bad, and he's just one, you know, classic example of it. By mid-1940, the country had moved very far to the right and was even more opposed than ever before to the entry of aliens. Everyone was a suspect. The fear in 1940 in America was like what happened after 9/11 in 2001, that, you know, the fear is anybody could be a terrorist, anybody could be a German agent. You just don't know who's who. So there were proposals for Washington officials to check every immigrant's file with a fine-tooth comb, even after consular approval abroad. In other words, let's say the consul general in whatever European city gives a stamp of approval to such a Jewish refugee to go to America. Still, it's not enough. Some bureaucrat in Foggy Bottom in Washington, D.C. has to go through the file again, and if they don't like something they see, forget about it, you're not coming to America. Now, with the 1940 elections quickly approaching, FDR could not afford to be seen as soft on national security. When it was expected that the Republican Party was going to make major congressional gains, just as they had in 1938. So some Republicans accused Jews of spying for the Nazis out of greed. Now that's a chutzpah, that the Republican Party, certain key officials in the Republican Party said, yeah, the Nazis hate the Jews, but the Jews are so avaricious that they would spy for the Nazis for a buck or for a Reichsmark. Okay, well, what happened next? In June of 1940, the State Department changed its guidelines. They not only did a visa applicant have to prove that they had good reason to leave Europe, they now had to also prove that they had good reason or good intention upon their arrival in the United States. But if there was any suspicion that they had some nefarious intention in the United States, no, you can't come in. Consuls were told to put up all sorts of roadblocks and bureaucratic obstacles to the refugees. One bright spot on the horizon was the founding of the United States Committee for the Care of European Children, with Eleanor Roosevelt as the nominal head, as the honorary chair. And they were able to save a small number of German Jewish children even as late as April of 1941. The only example where Roosevelt put his neck out and did something overt to save Jews, and explicitly Jews, was in August of 1940, when the ship, the Kwanzaa, the SS Kwanzaa, with 86 German Jewish passengers, was given asylum by President Roosevelt after an appeal by the First Lady. Breckinridge Long was furious and insisted that this never happen again. And guess what? It didn't happen again. It was a one-off of people being granted asylum outside the quotas, sort of in an extra legal manner, by the president. In the 1940 election, right-wing anti-Semites supported Wendell Willkie for president, but he repudiated their support. So again, like was the case with Alf Landon in 1936, the right-wing anti-Semites are going to support the Republican candidate, but the Republican candidate is not the devil and is not necessarily a Jew hater. Wendell Willkie wasn't. It's just that he's got this baggage because that side of the aisle wants him to win, but he repudiates their support. Charles Lindbergh was by far the most important public figure to support the Republican candidate and to oppose any rescue efforts and to oppose any entry of the U.S. into the war, to be a fierce advocate for isolationism. Roosevelt was convinced that Lindbergh was really a Nazi, that in his heart of hearts, Lindbergh was not just an isolationist, but that Lindbergh was really a Nazi. And Lindbergh probably was a Nazi. So Stephen Wise, you know, the chief Jew of America, he preferred the re-election of Roosevelt over the admission of a small number of refugees, meaning Wise did not want there to be a cause celeb in the weeks ahead of the November 1940 election, whereby Jews would be pressuring the government for the entry of a small number of refugees if that incident would then compromise Roosevelt's ability to win the election. That better our candidate win and we keep quiet for a little while, because then after the election is over, we'll have more of an opportunity to press our issue, to push our cause. And that's what he did. Okay, so he went to do battle of a refugee policy once Roosevelt had secured a third term, you know, 4 more years. There was discussion in October of 1940 regarding the President's Advisory Committee on Political Refugees, which had been around for a few years. Should Jews under Nazi control necessarily be regarded as being in imminent danger just because they're Jews? Or should it be that only those whose achievements or activities antagonize the Nazis should be regarded as political refugees? In other words, does the word political mean political? Or should we recognize that it all along had just been a code word for Jews? That's really the question. So you take a euphemism, and do we say that we're going to apply the euphemism literally or as it was really intended all along? Now, who wins the election? We all know Roosevelt wins re-election, a third term, and he wins handily. And the Democrats retained control of both houses of Congress. Now, while Roosevelt had softened his views on rescue in the aftermath of the 1936 election and in the aftermath of the midterms in 1938, he did not do so after the 1940 election. Why? I'll explain shortly. So, for example, when there was talk of using the Virgin Islands as a temporary haven, Roosevelt sided with Breckinridge Long and claimed to be concerned for American citizens on the Virgin Islands, and we can't inundate them with refugees. The German quota for 1941, which was 27,000, was not even half filled. Only about 10,000 came into the country despite a long waiting list. Breckinridge Long pushed for even more restrictions in 1941, including a ban on visas for anyone who intended to engage in political activity or to fundraise for political activity in the United States. So that would mean that, you know, activists from even from Eretz Yisrael, like the Bergson crowd, would not be allowed in because they were coming to cause trouble, to do political activity. In May 1941, the State Department approved a devastating new edict. It was known as the Close Relative Provision, and it prohibited the issuance of visas to anyone who had an immediate relative living in a totalitarian country. Now, what's a totalitarian country? Germany, Italy, and the Soviet Union. This provision, had it been put into effect and carried through for a while, would have crippled any rescue attempt geared towards potential Jewish victims of Nazism. After all, anyone you rescue is going to have some relative probably back in Germany or the Soviet Union. So it would destroy any chance of rescuing Jews. But the Jews were not the only ones who potentially would suffer from this. Who else might suffer from this? Catholics, because of Italy. And so a united Catholic Jewish front lobbied against the implementation of the close relative provision, and it was not implemented. In an August 1941 speech in Brazil, Nachum Goldman, of the World Jewish Congress, blamed American Jewish leaders for stymieing Roosevelt's efforts at rescue ever since 1933. So here's Goldman, who was a German Jew, who then went to Eretz Israel, then was living in Switzerland, and eventually comes to the United States, saying American Jewish leaders fouled up big time. That here we had a president who was our friend and was willing to do good things for us, but the American Jewish leaders were too afraid and they kept holding back Roosevelt. And what do you want from the guy? He can't be more Catholic than the Pope. So, I remember when certain right-wing Jews in America were angry at Bill Clinton in the mid to late 1990s over Oslo. And I remember thinking to myself, what do you want from the guy? Rabin was prime minister. You can't be more Catholic than the Pope. You know, if the Israelis want to make peace with Arafat, what are you blaming the American president for? So it's another example. You know, you can't expect the American president to be more pro-Jewish than the Jews themselves are. Okay. Well, FDR was moving the country towards war in 1940 and 41. How? Well, a peacetime draft in 1940. My grandfather was drafted or had papers to be drafted in May of 1941. And my grandparents got married legally, not Jewishly, in the summer of 41 to try to avoid him getting drafted, thinking if you were a married man, somehow that would work. Going to Shelfen. By December of 41, they got married, and then he was drafted, for real. But peacetime draft. So the other thing is, he sent 50 destroyers to England, and the Lend-Lease Act of 40 and 41. So clearly, Roosevelt is pro-British, anti-Nazi, wants to drag the country along with him. The isolationists view this as a Jewish communist plot. I repeat that. The isolationists in America viewed the shifting foreign policy and war policy of the Roosevelt administration towards pro-England, anti-German, as a Jewish communist plot. They saw communism, not fascism, as the chief threat to the United States. Wise and Goldman judged FDR favorably at this time because they saw his anti-Nazi efforts at a time when most Americans were not concerned about Nazism as being very important. And they gave him a pass on more parochial Jewish issues, meaning, yeah, Roosevelt wasn't good on rescue and the refugee crisis. He was mediocre at best, or you could argue he was bad. Maybe not super, super terrible, but not good. But because he was anti-Nazi and was taking the country in that direction, we'll cut him some slack. Okay. Well, contrary to the administration's wishes, Stephen Wise held a big rally at Madison Square Garden in 1940 to protest anti-Jewish laws passed by Vichy France. Charles de Gaulle sent greetings to this rally, saying that those anti-Jewish laws would have no force in a free France. So, you know, just remember, in 1940, Charles de Gaulle sending messages to Madison Square Garden to a pro-Jewish rally, I'm your friend, but later on in the 1960s, he wasn't the best friend of Israel. Okay. So, throughout the summer of 1941, Nazi propaganda in the United States claimed that the U.S. was barreling towards war because FDR was under Jewish influence. Lindbergh said, "The leaders of the British and Jewish races, for reasons that are un-American, are leading the country towards war." Hundreds of clubs around the United States lambasted Lindbergh and denounced his speech. Although, ironically, those were clubs that barred their doors to Jews. So, you know, you could be anti-Lindbergh for his anti-Semitism and also yourself be anti-Jewish. These permutations certainly existed. But by the summer of 1941, very important, very, very important, by the summer of 41, the tide was turning. Only 15% of Americans held Lindbergh's views by that time. The American populace was being won over to the idea that democracies and Western civilization had to fight together for survival against the devil of Hitler. Still, there were some senators who thought that there was undue Jewish influence in Hollywood among the producers of movies, that the theater-going public was being given subliminal messages favoring war. You know, the Hollywood directors, the Jews, we're convincing the public we got to go to war. You know, some would argue Casablanca is in that vein. You know, that December of 1941 and we're doing nothing, the classic line from Humphrey Bogart. Well, Roosevelt himself got into mocking the Senate Investigative Committee about on Hollywood. And he said the following. He read an apocryphal telegram from an unidentified senator about a subversive book. Quote, "Written entirely by foreign-born, mostly Jews. First part full of warmongering propaganda. Second part condemns isolationism. That fake story about Samaritan dangerous should be added to your list and suppressed. That book was the Bible." So he was mocking the isolationist senators, saying if you read the Bible, you'd ban that too, as being pro-Jewish. Okay. So by October 1941, very few Americans believed that it was the Jews who were hurtling the country towards war. Instead, what did people think? That it was Roosevelt himself, the Democratic Party, big business interests, and Anglo-American interests, British interests, were bringing the country towards war. Roosevelt spoke about the evils of Nazism, but in public, he did not emphasize the Jewish angle, lest that compromise the effort to convince the Americans that they needed to fight. In truth, there was only one Jewish, one Jew ever found guilty of spying for the Germans. And his name was Paul Borchardt. He was an archaeologist who was of Jewish ancestry, but was actually a practicing Catholic. And he was sent to Dachau in 1939, and then went to England, then went to the United States, and did some spying on behalf of the Germans, was sentenced to 20 years in prison, was released early in 1952 at the request of the West German government, and then died in 1953. So for all the talk that there were going to be German spies hidden, you know, embedded among the Jews, baloney, it never really happened. It was one person. Okay. When did FDR find out about the mass killing of Jews? It's a very important question. We don't know exactly the answer, but whenever it was, it would not have surprised him, because Roosevelt knew this was coming. He had read Mein Kampf, and he knew there was no real solution forthcoming to the refugee crisis, so the Germans are going to kill the Jews eventually. So why were there condemnation of other atrocities carried out by the Germans in 1941, but not the killing of Jews in the Ukraine, for example, at Babi Yar? Why is it that generic German atrocities in Western Europe are being called out, but not German atrocities against Jews? And so an astute Jewish observer of the scene realized what the answer was. He didn't agree with the morality of the answer, but he recognized what the answer was. And what was the answer? Quote, "Condemnation of Nazi atrocities in France are a weapon against isolationism, but the condemnation of atrocities against Jews would add fuel to the isolationist propaganda that the war against Hitler is a Jewish war." So that's a great chachma. He figured out what was going on here. If we say that the Germans are bad and they're killing innocent people, but you don't say those people are Jews, you say they're Goyim, well then, we Americans, as good people, have to fight a war against Hitler. But if you condemn the Germans for killing the Jews, then what happens? It looks like we're going to war to save the Jews. And then the Americans will not want to go to war. Okay. So, a big rally was held by Stephen Wise at his usual hangout, Madison Square Garden, on July 21st, 1942. And both Churchill and Roosevelt sent messages of support, but it was followed up by no real action. Roosevelt issued a generic warning about war crimes being punished after the war was over, and he did this on August 21st, 1942. But he didn't mention Jews specifically, nor the deportations. Well, what about the final solution? So was he familiar with it? The answer is the Riegner cable was shown to Stephen Wise in late August. But what do you do about it? So do you bang on the gates of the White House and insist that the president make a big statement? You try to go to Congress and change the immigration laws? What are you going to do? So one of the suggestions was that Americans should threaten retaliation against German civilians abroad, unless the Germans agreed to stop killing Jews. But that was never seriously considered. The State Department, however, did not really believe that the final solution was a fact. They thought this was an exaggeration. Why did they think that? So first of all, when you're not a friend of the Jews anyway, you're not likely to, you know, to take a sympathetic ear to Jewish suffering, and you're likely to say, oh, it's a big exaggeration. But also some people sincerely believe this wasn't really happening, that they thought that the Germans would not kill their slave labor population, that they would use slave labor for their advantage in the war effort. They wouldn't kill off people who could be used as slaves. Okay. Now the U.S. could do nothing about the killings. Why could the U.S. do nothing about the killings? Because America had no military hardware on continental Europe. America had no diplomatic leverage. There was nothing America could do other than shout and scream and yell to stop the killings in 42, 43, and even into part of 44. The only thing the Americans could do was send the diplomatic overture to Vichy France, because America maintained diplomatic relations with Vichy France, and to try to save some Jewish children. There was an attempt in 1940 to save 5,000 Jewish children from Vichy France, but the regime hardly cooperated. And in the end, only 500 children made it to Spain. For those of you who watched the movie, so Herman Wouks, War and Remembrance, which I highly recommend, Winds of War and War of Remembrance. It's available on YouTube. You'll spend 30 hours watching it over, you know, you'll binge watch it if you like it. I highly recommend it. So in one of the episodes of War and Remembrance, if you remember, so the protagonist woman and her child, Louis, were going to be rescued from Vichy France and to go to Spain or to go to Portugal. But what happened? The United States invaded North Africa. The United States invaded North Africa in November of 1942. Vichy France ceased to exist. The Germans came in, and the possibility of an orderly rescue disappeared. Okay. The Democrats did very badly in the 1942 midterm elections. Congress was under control of conservative Democrats and the Republicans. In other words, those who had a soft spot in their hearts for the refugees were not in control of the government. Roosevelt did not gain control of immigration policy in the Third War Powers Act. He requested control over who comes in, you know, who goes in the country, who leaves the country under the War Powers Act. It was not granted to him. Sumner Wells, who was the Undersecretary of State, allowed Stephen Wise to release information to the press about the Final Solution in November of 1942. So Wise had found out about it in late August and sat on it at the government's request until late November, around Thanksgiving time. The newspapers covered the story. Let it not be said that American newspapers failed to cover the exposure of the Final Solution in late 42. However, they put it on page 6, page 8, page 12. But why did they do that? After all, it was a juicy story. Why relatively bury the story of the Final Solution? And one of the answers is, aside from the fact that the newspapers, that it was insufficiently verified in the sense that the American government did not release this information. Who released it? A private citizen, a leader of the American Jewish Congress and the World Jewish Congress, a private American citizen, Stephen S. Wise, not the U.S. State Department. So if I'm a newspaper editor, am I going to risk running this as a front page headline? It's a gamble. They were not sufficiently convinced that this is the MS. Okay. Well, FDR did not want to meet with rabbis. He did not want to meet with Jews over this issue, but certainly not with rabbis. But he was pressured that he had to. And after the exposure, the Final Solution, something had to give. So on December 8th, 1942, Franklin Delano Roosevelt met with four Jews in the Oval Office for 29 minutes. Those Jews included Stephen Wise and Rabbi Rosenberg from Agudas Yisrael. Rabbi Rosenberg gave the bracha for a head of state, and Roosevelt was appreciative that he got a bracha from a long-bearded old world rabbi. But what happened in this meeting? This meeting was a cordial meeting, but Roosevelt didn't promise all that much. He was sympathetic, but non-committal in his response. He talked about how, with the U.S. invasion of North Africa, that they would get rid of the concentration camps that were in North Africa, and that the racist laws that had been passed by the French authorities in North Africa would be done away with. Which actually, there was an article about that in I think Tablet magazine not that long ago, saying that not enough was done on that front. Okay, now, wartime Roosevelt was stingy in his empathy for Jewish suffering. Let's assume that Roosevelt might have wanted to do a little bit more for the Jews, but he always felt constrained by his other bigger aims. And so during the war, he didn't show much of a friendliness, the likes of which he did show earlier on. So Dr. Win the War was the main answer to all the Jewish claims of you got to do something. Well, how are we going to rescue Jews? We're going to rescue Jews by winning the war as fast as possible. That will rescue the most Jews. Because any specific gamble about how to rescue, you know, particularly Jews, who's to say it'll work? It could backfire, it could hurt, it could help the enemy. That was the attitude that we're going to see. So I'm going to stop here and take questions. But next time, we're going to discuss what happens from late 42 or early 43 through the end of the war, including the founding of the War Refugee Board, which does, in fact, late in the game, save many, many Jewish lives. And why was it established? Because there was a lot of political pressure, most notably from Henry Morgenthau Jr., the only Jewish member of the cabinet, Secretary of the Treasury. So that's for next time. However, that is not next week, because next week will be the annual pre-Pesach history class. So we'll have a shiur, which we do every year before Pesach, of a historical nature about Passover. Then we'll be off for the Monday of Pesach, which is right after Motzei Yontif. And so it'll be a while before we get back to discussing issues of rescue during the Shoah. Okay, questions?
I have a question.
Yeah.
Oh, hi, Tina.
Hi, Tina.
Hi, how are you? I have a few questions. First of all, it was pretty well known in the 30s that the plan that Hitler had was to make the place Judenrein. The final solution did not come in to play until maybe 1940. Okay, so you had a certain amount of time to have an orderly effort to get the Jews out. So I don't know why this guy Rupi at that time said it was impossible. That's number one. Number two, why was Kennedy's father, Joe Kennedy, who was such an avowed anti-Semite, why was he sent as ambassador to England?
Very good question. Very good. Okay, so I'll give you an answer to that.
Oh, wait, I have it in order. Wait a second. A key country. It's very interesting that that the United States did not impound many of the Bund groups the way they impounded the Japanese. You know, they were so worried about traitors and about, you know, why not the Bund? And they were very vociferous and very active.
Okay so let me answer all three questions. One more.
I forget. I'm older already. I forget. And people like Breckinridge Long.
Yeah. I
mean, if a president feels that a guy is anti-Semitic, so blatantly anti-Semitic, why did he have him there as an influence? And why was Morgenthau so late in voicing his opposition to all this?
Okay, so let me see if I can get all your questions down. There's Joe Kennedy, Boone, Morgenthau, and I'm missing something.
Breckinridge Long.
Long, okay, what was the first question?
That the Judenrein, that the general plan in the 30s was...
Okay, good. Okay, so let me answer all these questions in order.
And Joe Kennedy.
Acharon. So the first question about, you know, if it was known that Germany wanted it to be Judenrein, so why was there no opportunity for an orderly rescue?
Right.
The answer is twofold. One, lack of a safe haven, meaning there was nowhere to send people, or there was insufficient space in the handful of havens that were going to allow Jews to accommodate the hundreds and hundreds of thousands who needed to go somewhere. That's point one. Point two is that the Germans were looking to have a confiscatory policy about Jewish assets, and they did not want Jews going out with a lot of money. They wanted to steal it. So if Jews are going to go broke, what other country is going to want to take them in? And that's why the Havara policy was a rare success story, in that Jews were allowed to take some percentage of their assets and put it to a good cause. But other than the Havara example in Palestine, it never worked out anywhere else. So the combination of anti-Semitism elsewhere in the world of not wanting Jews and of Germans insisting upon Jews leaving broke meant this was not going to work out. And then as war came closer and closer and you ran out of time, whatever limited options you had were lost. You know, there were a few options, mostly in Latin American countries.
There were like Madagascar.
Madagascar.
There were other places that were not so solidified, so ossified with hatred against the Jews.
Well, Shanghai became a place of refuge for people, but that's already for Eastern European types mostly. Because they had no visa laws. You could just go there. Okay, now the next question, Joe Kennedy. Why was Joe Kennedy ambassador to England? Very simple reason. Roosevelt didn't like him, thought he was a political threat domestically, and wanted him out of the country. So, because Joe Kennedy had, you know, delusions that he was going to become a big man one day, a president, and get him out of here, out of sight, out of mind. Now, as for the German-American Bund, so it happens to be the case that there were leaders of the right-wing fascist groups in the United States who were arrested.
They did not get off scot-free. By 1939, 40, 41, there were arrests made of right-wing fascist German supporters in America if they broke laws, and some of them did. And they the restrictionist immigration policies not only affected Jews, potential Jewish refugees, it also affected German Gentiles who harbored Nazi sympathies. They also couldn't get in. So there was action taken against the German Bund. However, as late as 1939, they were holding mass rallies in Madison Square Garden. So whoever owned the garden was taking money from the Jews and from the Jews' enemies. They were getting rental money left and right.
Unlike the Japanese, they weren't put in detention camps.
Okay, they were not, correct. So the reason why they were not is because of an assumption that German Americans had integrated themselves into society, as opposed to Japanese Americans who had not. On what basis was the assumption that this group had and this group hadn't? It probably just based, rank racism.
That
Americans didn't like Asians, and so we put the Japanese in an internment camp. But it also is true, though, that by 1941, there was almost no pro-German sentiment among rank-and-file Americans of German ancestry. That the German-American Bund was a subset of that culture, but that was small. I mean, it was too big for our comfort. The fact that it existed at all was no good. But still, there were millions and millions of Americans who had German ancestry, and they basically were Americans like everybody else. Whereas the Japanese, it was assumed that they had come more recently, had not assimilated thoroughly, and that there would be a lot of them who would harbor sympathy for Japan even after Pearl Harbor. And guess what? They probably were. But still, the Japanese internment was a mark of shame in the history of American, American governance, and it should not have been done. So that's that answer. Why was Morgenthau late in his efforts to save Jews? Well, the answer is Morgenthau was a team player. As the only Jewish cabinet member, he was a team player and didn't want to rock the boat. But when he saw that we're talking about the deaths of millions, and not just, threatening the well-being of people, that was too much for him. And he had to act in a big way and threaten to make, major exposure if nothing was done. As for Breckinridge Long and why were, anti-Semitic types allowed to run the State Department, the answer is because you didn't have many alternatives. It's not like you had, kind-hearted softies in the professional diplomatic ranks in the United States who were going to run a different policy. The country at large, as represented in Congress, wanted a restrictionist policy. They got it in a compliant State Department. And historically, the WASPy State Department was full of people who didn't want to have Jews in the country. So, there weren't others to put in their place. Later on, you'd have a lot of Jews in the State Department. Today you have Tony Blinken as the Secretary of State, a Jew. But you didn't have that back then.
And he was the worst of the worst.
Huh? What was that?
He was the worst of the worst.
Yeah. He was. Okay, we'll stop here. And the Pesach Shir will be on this link, same time, same channel. Next Monday, the pre-Pesach history Shir. Everybody take care. Bye-bye.
Bye. Thank you. Bye.